You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. There are still the optimists who work to persuade world governments to start aiming for a sustainable world. Let's hear what they think. More than a few scientists on Radio EcoShock tell us our present economy threatens perhaps to kill us and take out many other species in the sixth great mass extinction. Surely, we all have an interest in a new climate economy. And that's a huge global task. I've come across a report that seems written to me in a bland code for top government and corporate planners, but there are gems buried in this work titled The Sustainable Infrastructure Imperative. It's the 2016 report from something called the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate. Their website is newclimateeconomy.net. To help us sort out who that is and what this report can tell us, as citizens of this planet, I've called on Ipek Genshu. She's the research and engagement manager at the New Climate Economy. Ipek has degrees in politics and economy from the London School of Economics. You may also have heard about her as a campaigner for the charity Oxfam and for climate and food justice. From Washington, D.C., Ipek Genshu, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, it's great to be here.
To be honest, I'm a little afraid of this interview. Can we hope to translate this 2016 report into something that means something in the lives of our listeners?
I think we definitely can, because infrastructure is something that most of us live with every day, and I'm here to try to explain why I think it really touches all of us. It's important for all of us.
Okay, well, can you explain what the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate is and how it was formed?
Sure. So the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate was commissioned by seven countries in 2013. Those are UK, Norway, and Sweden, our three funding countries, and we also have Ethiopia, Korea, Indonesia, and Colombia, developing countries, and they got together and said, we need to do some really strong analysis to show whether we can have economic growth and reduce the effects of climate change at the same time. Now, there was a lot of worry at the time by countries implementing renewable systems who thought this is hurting our economy, it's too costly, and we just cannot do it because for the sake of our citizens, we have to prioritize a strong economy for them. So the commission got together and with the help of eight research institutes, but also a number of international organizations, experts in this field, we put together analysis in our flagship report in 2014, which showed from across the world examples of how sustainable growth, low carbon growth can be compatible with strong economic growth. And we followed up our work in the guidance of the Commission and an economic advisory panel over the past few years to dig a little bit more into detail in specific areas and also in different countries to show how this can be made possible.
And this report is about infrastructure. Can you give us examples of what that is?
Sure. As I mentioned, infrastructure is something we live with in our lives every day. It's the buildings that we live and we work in, our homes. It's the transport systems, it's the roads that we drive on and the train lines we take into work. It's also the source of our power. So the coal plants or solar panels, whatever source of power you use is what provides electricity for us and keeps us going. Our water systems, our sewage systems, that's all infrastructure. We look at infrastructure and we look at evidence across three sectors in our report. Those are cities, energy, and also land use. So we importantly say that land use is also a type of infrastructure. So irrigation systems, landscaping, all of these things are things that we impose on the existing landscape, and we see it as infrastructure.
How does the Global Commission define the difference between sustainable and unsustainable infrastructure?
So the definition isn't always very clear, but we go with three broad principles. One is that it has to be environmentally sustainable. So we are using the world's limited resources. We have to do it in a way that provides for future generations. The second component of environmental sustainability is, of course, climate change. So we have to make sure that we're limiting the effects of climate change by reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So sustainable infrastructure is also low carbon. The second component for us is it has to be economically sustainable. So it doesn't burden governments with debt for generations to come. And finally, it has to serve all. It has to be socially sustainable, not just the select few who can afford certain type of life, but it has to enable everybody access to work opportunities and to be connected to their families and live in healthy, happy environments.
This report contains a roadmap which identifies the need to stop subsidies of fossil fuels by taxpayers. Who are some of the countries who offer those subsidies, and how big is the total?
It's a lot of countries, a lot of developed countries, and also developing countries. Worldwide, there are about $500 billion of subsidies offered by governments to both the production and the consumption of subsidies. For example, Russia offers about $23 billion a year. In the U.S., the value is about $20 billion, actually just over $20 billion a year. This is federal subsidies as well as subsidies in fossil fuel producing states. And the difficult thing about subsidies is that they often benefit the middle class because they're making it cheaper to drive cars, they're making it cheaper to use electricity when a lot of the poorer segments of the population don't get most of the benefits. By comparison, quickly to also put in perspective, renewables only get around $120 billion per year as subsidies. So, there's a really a lot of money going into this to continue our high carbon-based way of development. And there are also good opportunities for reforming these subsidies, which has been happening in many countries, including in Indonesia, in Canada, and the U.S. and France as well. They are starting to restrict them, which is good.
Is the clean infrastructure we're looking for a responsibility that governments direct, or is the private sector involved?
It's obviously the public sector's responsibility because they owe it to their citizens to grow the countries in a good way and providing services to people. But for the private sector, actually, it's a great opportunity. It's a great financial opportunity because a lot of money goes into building the buildings and the transport systems, but then their use generates a lot of income for them. So it's an opportunity for both. In developed countries, about 60% of infrastructure is built using private funds. In developing countries, this is the other way around. So 60% comes from the government. We actually need to increase private financing towards infrastructure because we'll be making around $90 trillion of infrastructure investment across the world over the next 15 years. And a lot of this money will have to come from private and institutional investors.
And the report calls us to transform the financial architecture. Can you give us specific examples of what is needed?
Sure. So this sounds a bit jargony, but the main point is our financial systems and processes are based on a previous model of development, which was quite short-termist. It was based on fossil fuels. It was based on building roads and getting people to drive cars. So all the risks and opportunities are around providing for those. What we now need to do is to make sure the financial system works for renewable technologies, for green investment, for sustainable investment needs. And so the difference will be that there are more upfront costs, but in the longer term, there'll be lower operating costs. So for example, if we take the comparison of a coal plant versus solar panels, it is probably less costly to build a coal plant than the same amount of energy coming from solar panels. But once you build the coal plant, you have to keep supplying it with coal, whereas the sunshine is free. So the financial system has to take this into account and lower the risks of the upfront capital costs so that in the long run, the costs level out and investors are actually interested to invest in these technologies.
To hear the politicians talk, governments are investing heavily to help develop a survivable, low-carbon future. But we learned from this report that, quote, today's public research in development and deployment of energy as a share of GDP is half what it was in the 1980s, end quote. How is that possible, given the dangers we face from climate change and the challenges of feeding a growing population?
Yes, I mean, you're right that this figure is very worrying. We do have to invest more in sustainable technologies and research and development. I think part of the reason might be that there's a lot more private funding going into these areas, which is great. But we do need government funding to guide us in the right direction. Government funding is a big signal of the way things have to develop. And if they are signaling that these low-carbon technologies are a priority, that will also catalyze private funding towards them. The other thing that the governments need to help us fund is the deployment of existing technologies. We have a lot of technologies already available to us. The costs are coming down, and it's just a question of making sure that they get implemented in different businesses, in different areas, in schools, in buildings. A lot of these technologies, energy efficiency technologies, can be implemented, but we need to make sure that the government is supporting this.
Now, the 2016 report from the Global Commission begins by saying the existing stock and use of infrastructure is associated with more than 60% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. That's a shocking number, and where does that 60% number come from?
That comes from some analysis we did earlier on in our research in the first year, which basically says that all the processes that go into construction, into cement and steel production, and the emissions that come from their use, from power plants, from the use of motor cars, all of these add up to 60% of all our global emissions. So this is a very significant percentage. And of course, we have to keep building, but there are ways of getting this number down.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Ipek Genchsu, and we're talking about a new report from a global commission and the need for a new climate economy. The very first sentence of the executive summary raises questions for me. It says, quote, investing in sustainable infrastructure is key to tackling three simultaneous challenges, reigniting global growth, delivering on sustainable development goals, and reducing climate risk. Well, the last two are fine, but I realize the mantra for all politicians is growth, growth, growth. But our listeners question whether growth is possible in a world constrained by the limits of nature and the things we've been talking about, resources and atmosphere. So if we really want to save the species and the future climate, shouldn't we be talking about planned degrowth instead?
Well, in an ideal world, maybe you could say yes. But to be honest, this is not a realistic approach, I think. There are two issues with it. One is that it's not the way our world works. As you say, our politicians and high-level decision-makers, business leaders, have to look into a portfolio that is going somewhere, that is growing. So while I think there is a role for scientists and NGOs to keep pushing for minimizing this relentless growth, we do need a bit more of a realistic outlook on this. Secondly, we need to provide for the people in low-income countries and middle-income countries that still lack access to basic services and goods. They need access to healthcare, transport, education, and clean and safe housing. So we do need to grow their economies and their infrastructure systems. It's just a question of balancing between what some of us in the developing world consume on a daily basis and what others have to. So I can give you an analogy. If you had a wardrobe full of clothes, as most of us do in some parts of the world, you don't need any more. In fact, you could be recycling some of them. You could be giving them away. You could definitely reduce your amount of consumption. And this is what a lot of approaches of resource efficiency, such as circular economy approaches, help us do. On the other hand, as I said, many people do need access to things. If they have a wardrobe with nothing in there, they do need to provide for themselves. So we will have growth, but hopefully it will be a changing way of growth.
Well, I know you worked on climate justice issues, Ipek, and what is at stake for the women of this world?
Well, this is a really crucial point, and I probably cannot do justice to it as part of this interview. There are so many interlinking advantages and disadvantages for women in this sphere. But in short, we could say that in developing countries, many of the burdens of lack of infrastructure and services fall on women. So they are the ones who spend a considerable part of their day fetching water, providing food for the family. They're the ones who are suffering from health risks, and they're the ones who have to give up their education as a first member of the family. So making sure that the sustainable infrastructure is something that governments can provide will free up their time and their resources and empower them to be able to access the workforce and hopefully reach a level of equality with other parts of the population.
I'd like to address a question that came up in a short online video about this report at New Climate Economy. And it says, in the next 15 or 20 years, we're going to build around 1.5 times the infrastructure that already exists today. That frightens me because we're going to impinge on the world even more than we already do. Who says that's going to happen and where is it going to happen?
Well, so this is on an analysis that one of our partners, Brookings Institution, conducted for us. And it shows that the amount of infrastructure in place is pretty much the same as the amount that is going to be built. Now, this is based on some calculations which are looking at population growth trends and urbanization trends. By 2050, for example, we expect 70% of the world's population to live in cities. At the moment, about 30 to 40% of them do so. So it's going to be a huge increase. In India, about 400 million people will move to cities in the next 15 to 20 years. In China, about 300. In Nigeria, about 200. You know, this is a huge influx of people from rural areas into cities, and they will be requiring the services, the infrastructure that, again, most of us enjoy in more developed countries. And we will have to build a large amount of infrastructure to be able to provide for them, which is why exactly this point about sustainability is key, because the way in which we make these infrastructure decisions in the next 3 to 5 years will determine the future of our planet for decades to come.
That is an awe-inspiring number of refugees. It's or mass migration, let's call it, not to mention the refugees that we're expecting. So it's a huge change in the world population and where they live. Right about now, there are big projects, proposals sitting on the desks of legislators, prime ministers, and presidents awaiting approval. Some are pipelines, some are green mass transit. Most of them will produce still more greenhouse gases through cement and transport and mining and all that. Couldn't we just stop building infrastructure and help save the climate that way?
Well, as I said before, we could do it, but it's unrealistic. And also, it's not morally right. You know, there are a lot of people in the world who deserve access to services and healthcare and education. And there are about 1.7 billion people who have no electricity access. Can you imagine your everyday life without electricity? There are about 3 billion people who don't have clean cooking facilities. They're having to do makeshift solutions. And so we cannot stop building infrastructure, but we can be clever about the way we build it. We build it in ways that are sustainable, that provide for those people, and we don't build unnecessary things. We don't consume in unnecessary ways. In the developing world, we build smarter transport systems where many people can share transport or they can use public transport and train lines instead of building roads, which encourage individualized car use.
The new Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, just announced the National Climate Plan will include a price on carbon. Is that happening in many countries yet, and why does it matter?
Yes, so it's quite encouraging that about 40 countries and 20 subnationals are introducing carbon pricing. And it's important because carbon pricing basically means taking into account what it costs to continue to fund fossil fuels and a high carbon-based development model. So if you price carbon, that is, first of all, sending a signal to people saying, you know, we think this is costly to our country, the way we develop, so we should limit it. It's a good tool to be able to make decisions and allocations. If you take into account a cost of carbon, you can say this project, this renewable project, is less costly because it doesn't emit carbon emissions. And finally, it can raise financing. At the moment, as we discussed, a lot of government subsidies are going towards fossil fuel projects. And if you were to decrease that amount, that money could be used for much more useful areas, such as providing services and education to people. And just to finish up on that point, it's not just governments. About 1,200 companies across the world have introduced or are planning to, in the next couple of years, an internal carbon price. That means they're making their company decisions, taking into account the cost of emissions, which is very encouraging.
We've heard some stories about developing countries skipping the stage of fossil fuel development, going straight for greener technology. Is that just hype or is it happening?
It is happening. One of our commissioning countries, Korea, for example, has been able to do that really well and providing, as I mentioned, these connected transport systems for people and efficient housing. So it is possible, and it's actually posing really good opportunities for us in the developing world and low-income countries. For example, in Africa, where people don't even have internet access or landlines, they're able to buy mobile phones, and through that, they're able to pay in installments for solar lighting systems. This is exactly what we call leapfrogging. It's, you know, skipping past some of the business as usual ways of development that the high-income countries have experienced, and instead it's going straight through to cleaner, more sustainable ways, which are also better for countries' economies and for people's pockets.
Ipek Genshu, in addition to your qualifications in politics and economics, you have an activist background. Can you get some things done where you are now?
Yes. So I think activism is a very important part of this puzzle. And in fact, the important Paris Climate Agreement that was signed in December last year was the result of the collaboration between activists, NGOs, civil society, and businesses and government. So I think there's a really important role for all the different pieces of the puzzle to work together. In my role now, I'm much more working with decision makers in government, in ministries, and we really have to work around their constraints about, as we mentioned earlier, about economic growth and about having to meet financial targets. So I feel like in this role and as part of the new climate economy team, we're able to do that because we understand how they think, we understand the constraints they have, and we try to come up with solutions that work for them.
You know, after going through the 2016 report, I had the urge to rewrite the whole thing for the common person. We're the ones at the end of the new pipelines or switching on solar-powered lights instead. We buy the gas or electric-powered cars. Don't we need a vision of sustainable infrastructure that translates into the lives of voters, of the public?
Absolutely. Our mission in the new climate economy team is to influence high-level decision-makers, ministers and CEOs, etc. But there is a great need for the general public to make these arguments and, in fact, to switch their way of life, especially those of us in richer countries. We do have to make sure we make our everyday decisions in a way that is sustainable. And this is now emerging, especially amongst the millennials and the younger generation, through car sharing systems. You know, not everyone believes that you need to have your own car anymore because there are great apps that you can use on your mobile device which allow you to share with friends. There's a great recycling, circular economy practices where people are able to borrow from each other and recycle their furniture, their clothes, their books. These kind of things are already emerging, and we just need to keep doing it. We just need to encourage it, and we need to make it cool to live our lives in this way.
And at the end of the online video, Felipe Calderon says, it is time for us all to realize that sustainable infrastructure is not just one potential pathway among many, but the only growth path for our future. Could you tell us why this is true?
Well, one side of the story is the catastrophic predictions that some scientists are making if we were to continue in the path that we're on and the world's temperature, average temperature, increased beyond 3, 4, 5 degrees. That would become a completely inhabitable world with much more extreme weather events, with floods and hurricanes that would destroy many, many parts of the world. So we definitely don't want to go down that path, and we definitely don't want to take that risk. But on the other hand, there are some more important things that we're experiencing now every day, such as high levels of air pollution. You know, using the model of growth that we've used with fossil fuels, with cars, we are emitting so much carbon dioxide in the air, as well as other harmful gases, that it's really damaging our lives, it's damaging our lungs and our health. So this is the only growth story for the future, because it's the only one that will limit the risks for the planet, that will limit the health risks for us, and finally provide a sustainable and inclusive way of growth for the developing countries and the developing population.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. We have been diving for diamonds in a very big picture report from the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate. Our guide from the commission is the activist and expert Ipek Genshu. Thank you for your help, Ipek.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith. You can find this new report at newclimateeconomy.net, and I'll put links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info.